The state of her sari told him that she was a servant, but she was not servile.
"You look green as a fish," she said. "You young doctors, you come into a strange house and your liver turns to jelly. Come, Dr. Saab, they are waiting for you."
Clutching his bag a fraction too tightly, he followed her through the dark teak door into a spacious bedchamber that was as ill-lit as the rest of the house, although here there were shafts of dusty sunlight seeping in through a fanlight high on one wall. These fusty rays illuminated a scene as remarkable as anything the doctor had ever witnessed, a tableau of such surpassing strangeness that his feet began to twitch towards the door once again. Two more women, also built like professional wrestlers, stood stiffly in the light, each holding one corner of an enormous white bedsheet, their arms raised high above the head so that the sheet hung between them like a curtain. Mr. Ghani welled up out of the murk surrounding the sunlit sheet and permitted the nonplussed Adam to stare stupidly at the peculiar tableau for perhaps half a minute, at the end of which, and before a word had been spoken, the doctor made a discovery. In the very centre of the sheet, a hole had been cut, a crude circle about 7 inches in diameter.
"Close the door, Aya,"
Ghani instructed the first of the lady wrestlers, and then, turning to Aziz, became confidential.
"This town contains many good-for-nothings who have on occasion tried to climb into my daughter's room. She needs—"
He nodded at the three muscle-bound women.
"Protectors."
Aziz was still looking at the perforated sheet. Ghani said,
"All right, come on. You will examine my Nazim right now. Pronto."
My grandfather peered around the room.
"But where is she, Ghani Saab?" he blurted out finally.
The lady wrestlers adopted supercilious expressions and, it seemed to him, tightened their musculatures just in case he intended to try something fancy.
"Ah, I see your confusion," Ghani said, his poisonous smile broadening. "You Europe-returned chappies forget certain things. Dr. Saab, my daughter is a decent girl. It goes without saying. She does not flaunt her body under the noses of strange men. You will understand that you cannot be permitted to see her. No, not in any circumstances. Accordingly, I have required her to be positioned behind that sheet. She stands there, like a good girl."
A frantic note had crept into Dr. Aziz's voice.
"Ghani Saab, tell me how I am to examine her without looking at her."
Ghani smiled on.
"You will kindly specify which portion of my daughter it is necessary to inspect. I will then issue her with my instructions to place the required segment against that hole, which you see there. And so, in this fashion, the thing may be achieved."
"But what, in any event, does the lady complain of?"
my grandfather despairingly, to which Mr. Ghani, his eyes rising upwards in their sockets, his smile twisting into a grimace of grief, replied,
"The poor child, she has a too dreadful stomach ache."
"In that case," Dr. Z said with some restraint, "will she show me her stomach, please?"
Mercurochrome. Padma, our plump Padma, is sulking magnificently. She can't read and, like all fish lovers, dislikes other people knowing anything she doesn't. Padma, strong, jolly, a consolation for my last days, but definitely a bitch in the manger. She attempts to cajole me from my desk.
"Eat now. Food is spoiling."
I remain stubbornly hunched over paper.
"But what is so precious?"
Padma demands, her right hand slicing the air up, down, up in exasperation.
"To need all this writing, shiting."
I reply, now that I've let out the details of my birth, now that the perforated sheet stands between doctor and patient, there's no going back. Padma snorts. Wrist smacks against forehead.
"Okay, starve, starve. Who cares 2 pice?
Another, louder, conclusive snort. But I take no exception to her attitude. She stirs a bubbling vat all day for a living. Something hot and vinegary has steamed her up tonight. Thick of waist, somewhat hairy of forearm, she flounces, gesticulates, exits. Poor Padma. Things are always getting her goat. Perhaps even her name. Understandably enough, since her mother told her, when she was only small, that she had been named after the lotus goddess, whose most common appellation amongst village folk is the one who possesses dung. In the renewed silence, I return to sheets of paper which smell just a little of turmeric, ready and willing to put out of its misery a narrative which I left yesterday hanging in mid-air, just as Scheherazade, depending for her very survival on leaving Prince Shahryar, eaten up by curiosity, used to do night after night. I'll begin at once by revealing that my grandfather's premonitions in the corridor were not without foundation. In the succeeding months and years, he fell under what I can only describe as the sorcerous spell of that enormous and as yet unstained perforated cloth.
"Again?" Adam's mother said, rolling her eyes. "I tell you, my child, that girl is so sickly from too much soft living only, too much sweetmeats and spoiling, because of the absence of her mother's firm hand. But go, take care of your invisible patient. Your mother is all right with her little nothing of a headache."
In those years, you see, the landowner's daughter, Nazim Ghani, contracted a quite extraordinary number of minor illnesses, and each time a Shikarawala was dispatched to summon the tall young Dr. Saab with the big nose, who was making such a reputation for himself in the valley. Adam Aziz's visits to the bedroom with the shaft of sunlight and the three lady wrestlers became weekly events, and on each occasion he was vouchsafed a glimpse, through the mutilated sheet, of a different 7-inch circle of the young woman's body. Her initial stomachache was succeeded by a very slightly twisted right ankle, an ingrowing toenail on the big toe of the left foot, a tiny cut on the lower left calf.
"Tetanus is a killer, Dr. Saab," the landowner said. "My Nazim must not die for a scratch."
There was the matter of her stiff right knee, which the doctor was obliged to manipulate through the hole in the sheet. And after a time the illnesses leapt upwards, avoiding certain unmentionable zones, and began to proliferate around her upper half. She suffered from something mysterious which her father called finger rot, which made the skin flake off her hands, from weakness of the wrist bones, for which Adam prescribed calcium tablets, and from attacks of constipation, for which he gave her a course of laxatives, since there was no question of being permitted to administer an enema. She had fevers, and she also had subnormal temperatures. At these times his thermometer would be placed under her armpit, and he would hum and haw about the relative inefficiency of the method. In the opposite armpit she once developed a slight case of tinea cloris, and he dusted her with yellow powder. After this treatment, which required him to rub the powder in, gently but firmly, although the soft, secret body began to shake and quiver, and he heard helpless laughter coming through the sheet, because Nazim Ghani was very ticklish, the itching went away. But Nazim soon found a new set of complaints. She waxed anemic in the summer and bronchial in the winter.
"Her tubes are most delicate," Ghani explained, "like little flutes."
Far away the great war moved from crisis to crisis, while in the cobwebbed house Dr. Aziz was also engaged in a total war against his sectioned patient's inexhaustible complaints. And in all those war years, Nazim never repeated an illness.
"Which only shows," Ghani told him, "that you are a good doctor. When you cure, she is cured for good. But alas," he struck his forehead, "she pines for her late mother, poor baby, and her body suffers. She is a too loving child."
So, gradually, Dr. Aziz came to have a picture of Nazim in his mind, a badly fitting collage of her severally inspected parts. This phantasmed of a partitioned woman began to haunt him, and not only in his dreams. Glued together by his imagination, she accompanied him on all his rounds. She moved into the front room of his mind, so that, waking and sleeping, He could feel in his fingertips the softness of her ticklish skin, or the perfect tiny wrists, or the beauty of the ankles. He could smell a scent of lavender and chambellis. He could hear her voice and her helpless laughter of a little girl. But she was headless, because he had never seen her face. His mother lay on her bed, spread-eagled on her stomach.
"Come, come, and press me," she said. "My doctor son, whose fingers can soothe his old mother's muscles. Press, press, my child," with his expression of a constipated goose.
He kneaded her shoulders. She grunted, twitched, relaxed.
"Lower now," she said. "Now higher, to the right. Good. My brilliant son, who cannot see what that Ghani landowner is doing. So clever, my child, but he doesn't guess why that girl is forever ill with her piffling disorders.
Listen, my boy, see the nose in your face for once. That Ghani thinks you are a good catch for her, foreign educated and all. I have worked in shops and been undressed by the eyes of strangers so that you should marry that Nazim. Of course I am right. Otherwise, why would he look twice at our family?"
Aziz pressed his mother.
"Oh, God, stop now. No need to kill me because I tell you the truth."
By 1918, Adam Aziz had come to live for his regular trips across the lake. And now his eagerness became even more intense, because it became clear that after 3 years the landowner and his daughter had become willing to lower certain barriers. Now, for the first time, Ghani said,
"A lump in the right chest. Is it worrying, doctor? Look. Look well."
And there, framed in the hole, was a perfectly formed and lyrically lovely. "I must touch it," Aziz said, fighting with his voice. Ghani slapped him on the back.
"Touch, touch," he cried. "The hands of the healer, the curing touch, eh, doctor?"
And Aziz reached out a hand.
"Forgive me for asking, but is it the lady's time of the month?"
Little secret smiles appearing on the faces of the lady wrestlers, Ghani nodding affably.
"Yes, don't be so embarrassed, old chap. We are family and doctor now."
And Aziz, "Then don't worry. The lumps will go when the time ends. And the next time?"
"A pulled muscle in the back of her thigh, Dr. Sub. Such pain."
And there, in the sheet, weakening the eyes of Adam Aziz, hung a superbly rounded and impossible buttock. And now, Aziz, "Is it permitted that—" Whereupon a word from Ghani, an obedient reply from behind the sheet, a drawstring pulled, and pyjamas fall from the celestial rump, which swells wondrously through the hole. Adam Aziz forces himself into a medical frame of mind, reaches out, feels, and swears to himself in amazement that he sees the bottom reddening in a shy but compliant blush. That evening, Adam contemplated the blush. Did the magic of the sheet work on both sides of the hole? Excitedly, he envisaged his headless Nazim tingling beneath the scrutiny of his eyes, his thermometer, his stethoscope, his fingers, and trying to build a picture in her mind of him. She was at a disadvantage, of course, having seen nothing but his hands. Adam began to hope with an illicit desperation for Nazim Ghani to develop a migraine or a graze in her unseen chin, so they could look each other in the face. He knew how unprofessional his feelings were, but did nothing to stifle them. There was not much he could do. They had acquired a life of their own. In short, my grandfather had fallen in love, and had come to think of the perforated sheet as something sacred and magical, because through it he had seen the things which had filled up the hole inside him, which had been created when he had been hit on the nose by a tussock and insulted by the boatman tie. On the day the World War ended, Nazim developed the longed-for headache. Such historical coincidences have littered and perhaps befouled my family's existence in the world. He hardly dared to look at what was framed in the hole in the sheet. Maybe she was hideous. Perhaps that explained all this performance. He looked. And saw a soft face that was not at all ugly, a cushion setting for her glittering gemstone eyes, which were brown with flecks of gold, tiger's eyes. Dr. Aziz's fall was complete, and Nazim burst out, "But, Doctor, my God, what a nose!" Ghani angry, "Daughter, mind your—" But patient and doctor were laughing together, and Aziz was saying, "Yes, yes, it is a remarkable specimen. They tell me there are dynasties waiting in it." And he bit his tongue, because he had been about to add, "like snot." And Ghani, who had stood blindly beside the sheet for 3 long years, smiling and smiling and smiling, began once again to smile his secret smile, which was mirrored in the lips of the wrestlers. Meanwhile, the boatman Tai had taken his unexplained decision to give up washing. In a valley drenched in freshwater lakes, where even the very poorest people could and did pride themselves on their cleanliness, Tai chose to stink. For 3 years now, he had neither bathed nor washed himself after answering calls of nature. He wore the same clothes, unwashed, year in, year out. His one concession to winter was to put his chugger coat over his putrescent pajamas. The little basket of hot coals which he carried inside the chugger, in the Kashmiri fashion to keep him warm in the bitter cold, only animated and accentuated his evil odours. He took to drifting slowly past the Aziz household, releasing the dreadful fumes of his body across the small garden and into the house. Flowers died, birds fled from the ledge outside old Father Aziz's window. Naturally, Tai lost work. The English in particular were reluctant to be ferried by a human cesspit. The story went around the lake that Tai's wife, driven to distraction by the old man's sudden filthiness, pleaded for a reason. He had answered, "Ask our foreign-returned doctor, ask that Naku, that German Aziz." Was it then an attempt to offend the doctor's hypersensitive nostrils, in which the itch of danger had subsided somewhat under the anaesthetizing ministrations of love? Or a gesture of unchangingness in defiance of the invasion of the doctori attaché from Heidelberg? Once, Aziz asked the ancient straight out what it was all for, but Tai only breathed on him and rode away. The breath nearly felled Aziz. It was sharp as an axe. In 1918, Dr. Aziz's father, deprived of his birds, died in his sleep. And at once his mother, who had been able to sell the gemstone business thanks to the success of Aziz's practice, and who now saw her husband's death as a merciful release for her from a life filled with responsibilities, took to her own deathbed and followed her man before the end of his own 40-day mourning period. By the time the Indian regiments returned at the end of the war, Dr. Aziz was an orphan and a free man. Except that his heart had fallen through a hole some 7 inches across. Desolating effect of Tai's behaviour. It ruined Dr. Aziz's good relations with the lake's floating population. He, who as a child had chatted freely with fishwives and flower sellers, found himself looked at askance. "Ask that Nuku, that German Aziz!" Tai had branded him as an alien, and therefore a person not completely to be trusted. They didn't like the boatman, but they found the transformation which the doctor had evidently worked upon him even more disturbing. Aziz found himself suspected, even ostracized, by the poor, and it hurt him badly. Now he understood what Tai was up to. The man was trying to chase him out of the valley. The story of the perforated sheet got out too. The lady wrestlers were evidently less discreet than they looked. Aziz began to notice people pointing at him, women giggled behind their palms. "I've decided to give Tai his victory," he said. The 3 lady wrestlers, 2 holding up the sheet, the 3rd hovering near the door, strained to hear him through the cotton wool in their ears. "I made my father do it," Nazim told him. "These Jatajis won't do any more of their tittling and tattling from now on." Nazim's eyes, whole framed, became wider than ever. Just like his own when, a few days earlier, he had been walking the city streets, had seen the last bus of the winter arrive, painted with its colourful inscriptions. On the front, God willing, in green shadowed in red. On the back, blue shadowed, yellow crying, "Thank God," and in cheeky maroon, "Sorry, bye-bye," and had recognized, through a web of new rings and lines on her face, Ilse Lubin, as she descended. Nowadays, Garni the landowner left him alone with ear-plugged guardians. "To talk a little, the doctor-patient relationship can only deepen in strictest confidentiality. I see that now, Aziz-sab. Forgive my earlier intrusions." Nowadays, Nazim's tongue was getting freer all the time. "What kind of talk is this? What are you, a man or a mouse? To leave home because of a stinky Shakara man." "Oscar died," Ilse told him, sipping fresh lime water on his mother's tucked. "Like a comedian, he went to talk to the army and tell them not to be pawns. The fool really thought the troops would fling down their guns and walk away. We watched from a window, and I prayed they wouldn't just trample all over him. The regiment had learned to march in step by then. You wouldn't recognize them." As he reached the street corner across from the parade ground, he tripped over his own shoelace and fell into the street. A staff car hit him, and he died. "He could never keep his laces tied, that ninny." Here there were diamonds freezing in her lashes. "He was the type that gives anarchists a bad name." "All right," Nazim conceded. "So you've got a good chance of landing a good job. Agra University, it's a famous place. Don't think I don't know, university doctor." "Sounds good. Say you're going for that, and it's a different business." Eyelashes drooped in the hole. "I will miss you, naturally." "I'm in love," Adam Aziz said to Ilse Lubin, and later, "So I've only seen her throw a hole in a sheet one part at a time, and I swear her bottom blushes." "They must be putting something in the air up here," Ilse said. "Nazim, I've got the job," Adam said excitedly. "The letter came today, with effect from April 1919. Your father says he can find a buyer for my house and the gemstone shop also." "Wonderful," Nazim pouted. "So now I must find a new doctor, or maybe I'll get that old hag again who didn't know two things about anything." "Because I am an orphan," Dr. Z said, "I must come myself in place of my family members. But I have come nevertheless, Garni-sab, for the first time without being sent for. This is not a professional visit."
"Dear boy,"
Garni, clapping Adam on the back.
"Of course you must marry her, with an A1 fine dowry, no expense spared. It will be the wedding of the year. Oh, most certainly, yes."
"I cannot leave you behind when I go," Aziz said to Nazim. Garni said,
"Enough of this tamasha. No more need for this sheet tomfoolery. Drop it down, you women. These are young lovers now."
"At last," said Adam Aziz, "I see you whole at last. But I must go now, my rounds. And an old friend is staying with me. I must tell her. She will be very happy for us both, a dear friend from Germany."
"No, Adam Baba," his bearer said. "Since the morning, I have not seen Ilse Begum. She hired that old Thai to go for a Shikara ride."
"What can be said, sir?" Thai mumbled meekly. "I am honored indeed to be summoned into the home of a so great personage as yourself. Sir, the lady hired me for a trip to the Mughal Gardens to do it before the lake freezes."
"A quiet lady, Dr. Saab. Not one word out of her all the time. So I was thinking my own unworthy private thoughts, as all fools will. And suddenly, when I look, she is not in her seat, Saab. On my wife's head, I swear it. It is not possible to see over the back of the seat. How was I to tell?
Believe a poor old boatman who was your friend when you were young."
"Adam Baba," the old bearer interrupted. "Excuse me, but just now I have found this paper on her table."
"I know where she is." Dr. Aziz stared at Tai. "I don't know how you keep getting mixed up in my life, but you showed me the place once. You said certain foreign women come here to drown."
"I, Saab?"
Tai, shocked, malodorous, innocent.
"But grief is making your head play trick. How can I know these things?"
and after the body, bloated, wrapped in weeds, had been dredged up by a group of blank-faced boatmen, Tai visited the Shikara Halt and told the men there, as they recoiled from his breath of a bullock with dysentery,
"He blames me. Only imagine. Brings his loose Europeans here and tells me it is my fault when they jump into the lake. I ask, how did he know just where to look? Yes, ask him that. Ask that Nuku Aziz."
She had left a note. It read, "I didn't mean it." I make no comment. These events, which have tumbled from my lips any old how, garbled by haste and emotion, are for others to judge. Let me be direct now and say that during the long, hard winter of 1918-19, Tai fell ill, contracting a violent skin disease akin to that European curse called the King's Evil. But he refused to see Dr. Aziz and was treated by a local homeopath. And in March, when the lake thawed, a marriage took place in a large marquee in the grounds of Ghani, the landowner's house. The wedding contract assured Adam Aziz of a respectable sum of money, which would help buy a house in Agra, and the dowry included, at Dr. Aziz's especial request, a certain mutilated bedsheet. The young couple sat on a dais, garlanded and cold, while the guests filed past, dropping rupees into their laps. That night my grandfather placed the perforated sheet beneath his bride and himself, and in the morning it was adorned by three drops of blood, which formed a small triangle. In the morning the sheet was displayed, and after the consummation ceremony, a limousine hired by the landowner arrived to drive my grandparents to Amritsar, where they would catch the frontier mail. Mountains crowded round and stared as my grandfather left his home for the last time. He would return once, but not to leave. Aziz thought he saw an ancient boatman standing on land to watch them pass, but it was probably a mistake, since Tai was ill. The blister of a temple atop Sankara Acharya, which Muslims had taken to calling the Takat-i-Sulayman, or Seat of Solomon, paid them no attention. Winter-bare poplars and snow-covered fields of saffron undulated around them as the car drove south, with an old leather bag containing, amongst other things, a stethoscope and a bedsheet, packed in the boot. Dr. Aziz felt in the pit of his stomach a sensation akin to weightlessness. Or falling. And now I am cast as a ghost. I am 9 years old, and the whole family, my father, my mother, the brass monkey, and myself, are staying at my grandparents' house in Agra. And the grandchildren, myself among them, are staging the customary New Year's play. And I have been cast as a ghost. Accordingly, and surreptitiously, so as to preserve the secrets of the forthcoming theatricals, I am ransacking the house for a special disguise. My grandfather is out and about his rounds. I am in his room. And here, on top of this cupboard, is an old trunk covered in dust and spiders, but unlocked. And here, inside it, is the answer to my prayers, not just a sheet, but one with a hole already cut in it. Here it is, inside this leather bag, inside this trunk, right beneath an old stethoscope, and a tube of mildewed Vicks inhaler. The sheet's appearance in our show was nothing less than a sensation. My grandfather took one look at it and rose, roaring, to his feet. He strode up on stage and unghosted me right in front of everyone. My grandmother's lips were so tightly pursed they seemed to disappear. Between them, the one booming at me in the voice of a forgotten boatman, the other conveying her fury through vanished lips, they reduced the awesome ghost to a weeping wreck. I fled, took to my heels, and ran into the little cornfield, not knowing what had happened. I sat there, perhaps on the very spot on which Nadia Khan had sat, for several hours, swearing over and over that I would never again open a forbidden trunk, and feeling vaguely resentful that it had not been locked in the first place. But I knew, from their rage, that the sheet was somehow very important indeed. I have been interrupted by Padma, who brought me my dinner and then withheld it, blackmailing me. "So, if you're going to spend all your time wrecking your eyes with that scribbling, at least you must read it to me." I have been singing for my supper, but perhaps our Padma will be useful, because it's impossible to stop her being a critic. She is particularly angry with my remarks about her name.
What do you know, city boy? She cried, hand slicing the air. In my village, there is no shame in being named for the dung goddess. Write at once that you are wrong completely.
In accordance with my lotus wishes, I insert forthwith a brief paean to dung. Dung that fertilizes and causes the crops to grow. Dung which is patted into thin chapati-like cakes, when still fresh and moist, and is sold to the village builders who use it to secure and strengthen the walls of Kachka buildings made of mud. Dung, whose arrival from the nether end of cattle goes a long way towards explaining their divine and sacred status. Oh yes, I was wrong, I admit I was prejudiced, no doubt because its unfortunate odours do have a way of offending my sensitive nose. How wonderful, how ineffably lovely it must be to be named for the purveyor of dung. On April the 6th, 1919, the holy city of Amritsar smelled, gloriously, Padma, celestially, of excrement. And perhaps the beauteous reek did not offend the nose on my grandfather's face. After all, Kashmiri peasants used it, as described above, for a kind of plaster. Even in Srinagar, hawkers with barrows of round dung cakes were not an uncommon sight. But then the stuff was drying, muted, useful. Amritsar dung was fresh and worse, redundant. Nor was it all bovine. It issued from the rumps of the horses between the shafts of the city's many tongas, ikkas and gharis, and mules and men and dogs attended nature's calls, mingling in a brotherhood of shit. But there were cows, too, sacred kine, roaming the dusty streets, each patrolling its own territory, staking its claims in excrement. And flies, public enemy number one, buzzing gaily from turd to steaming turd, celebrated and cross-pollinated these freely given offerings. The city swarmed about, too, mirroring the motion of the flies. Dr. Aziz looked down from his hotel window onto this scene as a Jain in a face mask walked past, brushing the pavement before him with a twig broom to avoid stepping on an ant, or even a fly. Spicy, sweet fumes rose from a street snack barrow.
Hot pakoras, pakoras, hot!
A white woman was buying silks from a shop across the street, and men in turbans were ogling her. Nazim, now Nazim Aziz, had a sharp headache. It was the first time she'd ever repeated an illness, but life outside her quiet valley had come as something of a shock to her. There was a jug of fresh lime water by her bed, emptying rapidly. Aziz stood at the window, inhaling the city. The spire of the Golden Temple gleamed in the sun, but his nose itched. Something was not right here. Close up of my grandfather's right hand. Nails, knuckles, fingers, all somehow bigger than you'd expect. Clumps of red hair on the outside edges, thumb and forefinger pressed together, separated only by a thickness of paper. In short, my grandfather was holding a pamphlet. It had been inserted into his hand. We cut to a long shot. Nobody from Bombay should be without a basic film vocabulary. As he entered the hotel foyer. Scurrying of urchin through revolving door, leaflets falling in his wake, as the chaprasi gives chase. Mad revolutions in the doorway, round and round, until chaprasi hand demands a close-up too, because it is pressing thumb to forefinger, the two separated only by the thickness of urchin ear. Ejection of juvenile disseminator of gutter tracts. But still, my grandfather retained the message. Now, looking out of his window, he sees it echoed on the wall opposite, and there, on the minaret of a mosque, and in the large black type of newsprint, under a hawker's arm. Leaflet, newspaper, mosque, and wall are crying, Hartal, which is to say, literally speaking, a day of mourning, of stillness, of silence. But this is India in the heyday of the Mahatma, when even language obeys the instructions of Gandhiji, and the word has acquired under his influence new resonances. Hartal, April 7th. Agree, mosque, newspaper, wall and pamphlet, because Gandhi has decreed that the whole of India shall, on that day, come to a halt, to mourn in peace the continuing presence of the British.
I do not understand this hartal when nobody is dead. Nazim is crying softly. Why will the train not run? How long are we stuck for?
Dr. Aziz notices a soldierly young man in the street and thinks that Indians have fought for the British, so many of them have seen the world by now and been tainted by abroad. They will not easily go back to the old world. The British are wrong to try and turn back the clock.
It was a mistake to pass the Rowlatt Act, he murmurs.
What Rowlatt? Wails Nazim. This is nonsense where I'm concerned.
Against political agitation, Aziz explains, and returns to his thoughts. Tai once said,
Kashmiris are different. Cowards, for instance. Put a gun in a Kashmiri's hand, and it will have to go off by itself. He'll never dare to pull the trigger.
We are not like Indians, always making battles.
Aziz, with Tai in his head, does not feel Indian. Kashmir, after all, is not, strictly speaking, a part of the empire, but an independent princely state. He is not sure if the Hartal of Pamphlet Mosque Wall newspaper is his fight, even though he is in occupied territory now. He turns from the window to see Nazim weeping into a pillow. She has been weeping ever since he asked her on their second night to move a little.
Move where? She asked. Move how?
He became awkward and said, only move, I mean, like a woman.
She shrieked in horror. My God, what have I married? I know you Europe-returned men. You find terrible women, and then you try to make us girls be like them. Listen, Dr. Saab, husband or no husband, I am not any... bad word, woman.
This was a battle my grandfather never won, and it set the tone for their marriage, which rapidly developed into a place of frequent and devastating warfare, under whose depredations the young girl behind the sheet and the gauche young doctor turned rapidly into different, stranger beings.
"What now, wife?" Aziz asks. Nazim buries a face in the pillow.
"What else?"
she says in muffled tones.
"You or what? You want me to walk naked in front of strange men?"
He has told her to come out of Purda. He says,
your shirt covers you from neck to wrist to knee. Your loose pajamas hide you down to and including your ankles. What we have left are your feet and face.
Wife, are your face and feet obscene?
But she wails,
they will see more than that. They will see my deep, deep shame.
And now, an accident which launches us into the world of Mercurochrome. Aziz, finding his temper slipping from him, drags all his wife's purda veils from her suitcase, flings them into a waste paper basket made of tin with a painting of Guru Nanak on the side, and sets fire to them. Flames leap up, taking him by surprise, licking at curtains. Adam rushes to the door and yells for help as the cheap curtains begin to blaze, and bearers, guests, washerwomen stream into the room and flap at the burning fabric with dusters, towels and other people's laundry. Buckets are brought, the fire goes out, and Nazim cowers on the bed as about 35 Sikhs, Hindus and untouchables throng in the smoke-filled room. Finally, they leave, and Nazim unleashes two sentences before clamping her lips obstinately shut.
You are a madman. I want more lime water.
My grandfather opens the windows, turns to his bride.
The smoke will take time to go. I will take a walk. Are you coming?
Lips clamped, eyes squeezed, a single violent no from the head, and my grandfather goes into the streets alone. His parting shot,
forget about being a good Kashmiri girl. Start thinking about being a modern Indian woman.
While in the cantonment area, at British Army HQ, one Brigadier R.E. Dyer is waxing his moustache. It is April 7th, 1919, and in Amritsar, the Mahatma's grand design is being distorted. The shops have shut, the railway station is closed, but now rioting mobs are breaking them up. Dr. Aziz, leather bag in hand, is out in the streets, giving help wherever possible. Trampled bodies have been left where they fell. He is bandaging wounds, daubing them liberally with mercurochrome, which makes them look bloodier than ever, but at least disinfects them. Finally, he returns to his hotel room, his clothes soaked in red stains, and Nazim commences a panic.
Let me help! Let me help, Allah! What a man I've married who goes into gullies to fight with gundas!
She is all over him with water on wads of cotton wool.
I don't know. Why can't you just be a respectable doctor like ordinary people are? Just cure important illnesses and all. Oh, God, you've got blood everywhere. Sit, sit now. Let me wash you at least.
It isn't blood, wife.
You think I can't see for myself with my own eyes? Why must you make a fool of me, even when you're hurt? Must your wife not look after you, even?
It's mercurochrome, Nazim. Red medicine. Nazim, who had become a whirlwind of activity, seizing clothes, running taps, freezes.
You do it on purpose, she says, to make me look stupid. I'm not stupid. I have read several books.
It is April 13th, and they are still in Amritsar. This affair isn't finished, Adam Aziz told Nazim. We can't go, you see. They may need doctors again.
So we must sit here and wait until the end of the world?
He rubbed his nose. No, not so long, I'm afraid. That afternoon, the streets are suddenly full of people, all moving in the same direction, defying Dyer's new martial law regulations. Adam tells Nazim, there must be a meeting planned. There will be trouble from the military. They have banned meetings.
Why do you have to go? Why not wait to be called?
A compound can be anything from a wasteland to a park. The largest compound in Amritsar is called Jallianwala Bagh. It is not grassy. Stones, cans, glass and other things are everywhere. To get into it, you must walk down a very narrow alleyway between two buildings. On April 13th, many thousands of Indians are crowding through this alleyway.
It is peaceful protest, someone tells Dr. Aziz.
Swept along by the crowds, he arrives at the mouth of the alley. A bag from Heidelberg is in his right hand. No close-up is necessary. He is, I know, feeling very scared because his nose is itching worse than it ever has. But he is a trained doctor. He puts it out of his mind. He enters the compound. Somebody is making a passionate speech. Hawkers move through the crowd selling chana and sweetmeats. The air is filled with dust. There do not seem to be any gundas, any troublemakers, as far as my grandfather can see. A group of Sikhs has spread a cloth on the ground and is eating, seated around it. There is still a smell of ordure in the air. Aziz penetrates the heart of the crowd as Brigadier R.E. Dyer arrives at the entrance to the alleyway, followed by 50 crack troops. He is the martial law commander of Amritsar, an important man after all. The waxed tips of his moustache are rigid with importance. As the 51 men march down the alleyway, a tickle replaces the itch in my grandfather's nose. The 51 men enter the compound and take up positions, 25 to Dyer's right and 25 to his left, and Adam Aziz ceases to concentrate on the events around him as the tickle mounts to unbearable intensities. As Brigadier Dyer issues a command, the sneeze hits my grandfather full in the face. He sneezes and falls forward, losing his balance, following his nose and thereby saving his life. His doctori attaché flies open. Bottles, liniment and syringes scatter in the dust. He is scrabbling furiously at people's feet, trying to save his equipment before it is crushed. There is a noise like teeth chattering in winter and someone falls on him. Red stuff stains his shirt. There are screams now and sobs and the strange chattering continues. More and more people seem to have stumbled and fallen on top of my grandfather. He becomes afraid for his back. The clasp of his bag is digging into his chest, inflicting upon it a bruise so severe and mysterious that it will not fade until after his death, years later, on the hill of Sankara Acharya or Takat-i-Sulayman. His nose is jammed against a bottle of red pills. The chattering stops and is replaced by the noises of people and birds. There seems to be no traffic noise whatsoever. Brigadier Dyer's 50 men put down their machine guns and go away. They have fired a total of 1,650 rounds into the unarmed crowd. Of these, 1,516 have found their mark. Killing or wounding some person.
Good shooting, Dyer tells his men. We have done a jolly good thing.
When my grandfather got home that night, my grandmother was trying hard to be a modern woman,
to please him, and so she did not turn a hair at his appearance. "I see you've been spilling the mercurochrome again, clumsy," she said appeasingly.
"It's blood," he replied as she fainted.
When he brought her round with the help of a little sal volatile, she said, "Are you hurt?"
"No," he said.
"But where have you been, my God?"
"Nowhere on earth," he said, and began to shake in her arms.
My own hand, I confess, has begun to wobble, not entirely because of its theme, but because I have noticed a thin crack, like a hair, appearing in my wrist beneath the skin. No matter. We all owe death a life. So let me conclude with the uncorroborated rumour that the boatman Tai, who recovered from his scrofulous infection soon after my grandfather left Kashmir, did not die until 1947, when, the story goes, he was infuriated by India and Pakistan's struggle over his valley, and walked to Chamb with the express purpose of standing between the opposing forces and giving them a piece of his mind. "Kashmir for the Kashmiris," that was his line. Naturally, they shot him. Oscar Lubin would probably have approved of his rhetorical gesture. R.E. Dyer might have commended his murderer's rifle skills. I must go to bed. Padma is waiting, and I need a little warmth. Hit the spittoon. Please believe that I am falling apart. I am not speaking metaphorically, nor is this the opening gambit of some melodramatic, riddling, grubby appeal for pity. I mean quite simply that I have begun to crack all over like an old jug, that my poor body, singular, unlovely, buffeted by too much history, subjected to drainage above and drainage below, mutilated by doors, brained by spittoons, has started coming apart at the seams. In short, I am literally disintegrating. Slowly for the moment, although there are signs of acceleration. I ask you only to accept, as I have accepted, that I shall eventually crumble into, approximately, 630 million particles of anonymous and necessarily oblivious dust. This is why I have resolved to confide in paper before I forget. We are a nation of forgetters. There are moments of terror, but they go away. Panic, like a bubbling sea beast, comes up for air, boils on the surface, but eventually returns to the deep. It is important for me to remain calm. I chew betel nut and expectorate in the direction of a cheap brassy bowl, playing the ancient game of hit the spittoon, Nadir Khan's game, which he learned from the old men in Agra. And these days you can buy rocket pans in which, as well as the gum-reddening paste of the beetle, the comfort of cocaine lies folded in a leaf. But that would be cheating. Rising from my pages comes the unmistakable whiff of chutney, so let me obfuscate no further. I, Salim Sanai, possessor of the most delicately gifted olfactory organ in history, have dedicated my latter days to the large-scale preparation of condiments. But now, a cook? You gasp in horror? A kansama merely? How is it possible? And I grant, such mastery of the multiple gifts of cookery and language is rare indeed, yet I possess it. You are amazed, but then I am not, you see. One of your 200 rupees a month cookery johnnies, but my own master working beneath the saffron and green winking of my personal neon goddess. And my chutneys and kasundis are, after all, connected to my nocturnal scribblings. By day amongst the pickle vats, by night within these sheets, I spend my time at the great work of preserving. Memory as well as fruit is being saved from the corruption of the clocks. But here is Padma at my elbow, bullying me back into the world of linear narrative, the universe of what happened next. "At this rate," Padma complains, "you'll be 200 years old before you manage to tell about your birth." She is affecting nonchalance, jutting a careless hip in my general direction, but doesn't fool me. I know that she is, despite all her protestations, hooked. No doubt about it. My story has her by the throat. So that all at once she stopped nagging me to go home, to take more baths, to change my vinegar-stained clothes, to abandon even for a moment this darkling pickle factory, where the smells of spices are forever frothing in the air. Now my dung goddess simply makes up a cot in the corner of this office and prepares my food on 2 blackened gas rings, only interrupting my angle-poised-lit writing to expostulate. "You better get a move on, or you'll die before you get yourself born." Fighting down the proper pride of the successful storyteller, I attempt to educate her. "Things, even people, have a way of leaking into each other," I explain, "like flavors when you cook. Ilse Lubin's suicide, for example, leaked into old Adam and sat there in a puddle until he saw God. Likewise," I intone earnestly, "the past has dripped into me, so we can't ignore it." Her shrug, which does pleasantly wavy things to her chest, cuts me off. "To me it's a crazy way of telling your life story," she cries, "if you can't even get to where your father met your mother." And certainly Padma is leaking into me. As history pours out of my fissured body, my lotus is quietly dripping in with her down-to-earthery and her paradoxical superstition, her contradictory love of the fabulous. So it's appropriate that I'm about to tell the story of the death of Mian Abdullah, the doomed hummingbird, a legend of our times. And Padma is a generous woman, because she stays by me in these last days, although I can't do much for her. That's right, and once again, it's a fitting thing to mention before I launch into the tale of Nadir Khan. I am unmanned. Despite Padma's many and varied gifts and ministrations, I can't leak into her, not even when she puts her left foot on my right, winds her right leg around my waist, inclines her head up towards mine and makes cooing noises, not even when she whispers in my ear, "So now that the writery is done, let's see if we can make your other pencil work." Despite everything she tries, I cannot hit her spittoon. Enough confessions. Bowing to the ineluctable Padma pressures of what happened nextism, and remembering the finite quantity of time at my disposal, I leap forwards from Mercurochrome and land in 1942. I'm keen to get my parents together too. It seems that in the late summer of that year, my grandfather, Dr. Adam Aziz, contracted a highly dangerous form of optimism. Bicycling around Agra, he whistled piercingly, badly, but very happily. He was by no means alone, because despite strenuous efforts by the authorities to stamp it out, this virulent disease had been breaking out all over India that year, and drastic steps were to be taken before it was brought under control. The old man at the pawn shop at the top of Cornwallis Road chewed betel and suspected a little trick.
"I have lived twice as long as I should have," the oldest one said,
his voice crackling like an old radio because decades were rubbing up against each other around his vocal cords.
"And I've never seen so many people so cheerful in such a bad time. It is the devil's work."
It was indeed a resilient virus. The weather alone should have discouraged such germs from breeding, since it had become clear that the rains had failed. The earth was cracking, dust ate the edges of roads, and on some days huge gaping fissures appeared in the midst of macadamed intersections. The beetle chewers at the pawn shop had begun to talk about omens. Calming themselves with their game of hit the spittoon, they speculated upon the numberless, nameless God knows whats that might now issue from the fissuring earth. Apparently a Sikh from the bicycle repair shop had had his turban pushed off his head in the heat of one afternoon, when his hair, without any reason, had suddenly stood on end. And more prosaically, the water shortage had reached the point where milkmen could no longer find clean water with which to adulterate the milk. Far away, there was a world war in progress once again. In Agra, the heat mounted, but still my grandfather whistled. The old man at the pawn shop found his whistling in rather poor taste, given the circumstances. And I, like them, expectorate and rise above fissures. Astride his bicycle, leather attaché attached to carrier, my grandfather whistled. Despite irritations of the nose, his lips pursed. Despite a bruise on his chest, which had refused to fade for 23 years, his good humour was unimpaired. Air passed his lips and was transmuted into sound. He whistled an old German tune, Tannenbaum. The optimism epidemic had been caused by one single human being, whose name, Mian Abdullah, was only used by newspaper men. To everyone else, he was the hummingbird, a creature which would be impossible if it did not exist.
"Magician turned conjurer,"
the newspaperman wrote. Me and Abdullah rose from the famous magician's ghetto in Delhi to become the hope of India's 100 million Muslims. The Hummingbird was the founder, chairman, unifier, and moving spirit of the Free Islam Convocation. And in 1942, marquees and rostrums were being erected on the Agra Maidan, where the convocation's second annual assembly was about to take place. My grandfather, 52 years old, his hair turned white by the years and other afflictions, had begun whistling as he passed the Maidan. Now he leaned round corners on his bicycle, taking them at a jaunty angle, threading his way between cowpats and children, and, in another time and place, told his friend the Rani of Kuchnaheen, I started off as a Kashmiri and not much of a Muslim. Then I got a bruise on the chest that turned me into an Indian. I'm still not much of a Muslim, but I'm all for Abdullah. He's fighting my fight. His eyes were still the blue of Kashmiri sky. He arrived home, and although his eyes retained a glimmer of contentment, the whistling stopped. Because waiting for him in the courtyard filled with malevolent geese were the disapproving features of my grandmama, Nazim Aziz, whom he had made the mistake of loving in fragments, and who was now unified and transmuted into the formidable figure she would always remain, and who was always known by the curious title of Reverend Mother. She had become a prematurely old, wide woman with two enormous moles like witches' nipples on her face, and she lived within an invisible fortress of her own making, an ironclad citadel of traditions and certainties. Earlier that year, Adam Aziz had commissioned life-size blurb photographs of his family to hang on the living room wall. The three girls and two boys had posed dutifully enough, but Reverend Mother had rebelled when her turn came. Eventually, the photographer had tried to catch her unawares, but she seized his camera and broke it over his skull. Fortunately, he lived, but there are no photographs of my grandmother anywhere on the earth. She was not to be trapped in anyone's little black box. It was enough for her that she must live in unveiled barefaced shamelessness. There was no question of allowing the fact to be recorded. It was perhaps the obligation of facial nudity, coupled with Aziz's constant request for her to move beneath him, that had driven her to the barricades, and the domestic rules she established were a system of self-defense so impregnable that Aziz, after many fruitless attempts, had more or less given up trying to storm her many ravelins and bastions, leaving her, like a large smug spider, to rule her chosen domain. Perhaps, too, it wasn't a system of self-defense at all, but a means of defense against herself. Among the things to which she denied entry were all political matters. When Dr. Aziz wished to talk about such things, he visited his friend, the Rani, and Reverend Mother sulked, but not very hard, because she knew his visits represented a victory for her. The twin hearts of her kingdom were her kitchen and her pantry. I never entered the former, but remembered staring through the pantry's locked screen doors at the enigmatic world within, a world of hanging wire baskets covered with linen cloths to keep out the flies, of tins which I knew to be full of gur and other sweets, of locked chests with neat square labels, of nuts and turnips and sacks of grain, of goose eggs and wooden brooms. Pantry and kitchen were her inalienable territory, and she defended them ferociously. When she was carrying her last child, my Aunt Emerald, her husband offered to relieve her of the chore of supervising the cook. She did not reply, but the next day, when Aziz approached the kitchen, she emerged from it with a metal pot in her hands and barred the doorway. She was fat and also pregnant, so there was not much room left in the doorway. Adam Aziz frowned. "What is this, wife?" To which my grandmother answered, "This, what's his name, is a very heavy pot, and if just once I catch you in here, what's his name, I'll push your head into it. Add some dahi and make what's his name a korma." I don't know how my grandmother came to adopt the term what's his name as her leitmotif, but as the years passed, it invaded her sentences more and more often. I like to think of it as an unconscious cry for help, as a seriously meant question. Reverend Mother was giving us a hint that, for all her presence and bulk, she was adrift in the universe. She didn't know, you see,
what it was called. And at the dinner table, imperiously she continued to rule. No food was set upon the table, no plates were laid. Curry and crockery were marshalled upon a low side table by her right hand, and Aziz and the children ate what she dished out. It is a sign of the power of this custom that, even when her husband was afflicted by constipation, she never once permitted him to choose his food, and listened to no requests or words of advice. A fortress may not move, not even when its dependents' movements become irregular. During the long concealment of Nadir Khan, during the visits to the house on Cornwallis Road of young Zulfikar, who fell in love with Emerald, and of the prosperous Racine and leathercloth merchant named Ahmed Sanai, who hurt my Aunt Alia so badly that she bore a grudge for 25 years before discharging it cruelly upon my mother, Reverend Mother's iron grip upon her household never faltered. And even before Nadia's arrival precipitated the great silence, Adam Aziz had tried to break this grip and been obliged to go to war with his wife. All this helps to show how remarkable his affliction by optimism actually was. In 1932, 10 years earlier, he had taken control of his children's education. Reverend Mother was dismayed, but it was a father's traditional role, so she could not object. Alia was 11, the second daughter. Mumtaz was almost 9. Two boys, Hanif and Mustafa, were 8 and 6, and young Emerald was not yet 5. Reverend Mother took to confiding her fears to the family cook, Daud.
"He fills their heads with I don't know what foreign languages, what's his name, and other rubbish also, no doubt."
Daud stirred pots, and Reverend Mother cried,
"Do you wonder what's his name, that the little one calls herself Emerald? In English, what's his name? That man will ruin my children for me. Put less cumin in that. What's his name? You should pay more attention to your cooking and less to minding other people's business."
She made only one educational stipulation, religious instruction. Unlike Aziz, who was racked by ambiguity, she had remained devout.
"You have your hummingbird," she told him, "but I, what's his name, have the call of God. A better noise, what's his name, than that man's hum."
It was one of her rare political comments. And then the day arrived when Aziz threw out the religious tutor. Thumb and forefinger closed around the Maulvi's ear. Nazim Aziz saw her husband leading the straggle-bearded wretch to the door in the garden wall, gasped, then cried out as her husband's foot was applied to the divine's fleshy parts. Unleashing thunderbolts, Reverend Mother sailed into battle.
"Man without dignity," she cursed her husband, "and man without what's-his-name, shame."
Children watched from the safety of the back veranda, and Aziz, "Do you know what that man was teaching your children?" And Reverend Mother, hurling question against question,
"What will you not do to bring disaster, what's-his-name, on our heads?"
But now Aziz, "You think it was Nastalik script, eh?" To which his wife, warming up,
"Would you eat pig, what's-his-name? Would you spit on the Quran?"
And voice rising, the doctor riposte, "Or was it some verses of the cow? You think that—" Paying no attention, Reverend Mother arrives at her climax.
"Would you marry your daughters to Germans?"
And pauses, fighting for breath, letting my grandfather reveal.
"He was teaching them to hate, wife. He tells them to hate Hindus and Buddhists and Jains and Sikhs, and who knows what other vegetarians. Will you have hateful children, woman? Will you have godless ones?"
Reverend Mother envisages the legions of the Archangel Gabriel descending at night to carry her heathen brood to hell.